Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Vanity Fair.
You know, some swans actually drown under the beauty and weight of their fantastical superficial plumage.
Hello, and welcome to Still Watching, a television podcast from Vanity Fair. I'm Hilary Busis.
I'm Richard Lawson.
And I'm Chris Murphy. And we're here to discuss FX's feud, Capote versus the Swans.
When they rebuilt your face, you were suddenly more beautiful than ever. You became a swan from an ugly duckling, am I right?
Later, the showrunner, John Robin Bates, will be stopping by to talk about frenemies in New York's high society and how the show came together.
But before we talk to John Robin Bates, I think we got to know, why are we talking about the show now? The show is come and gone. Why now?
Because it's good, and it's Emmy season, and we didn't get to talk about it when it was originally airing.
Yes, because it aired at the same time as True Detective, which we were covering in great detail. And yeah, it's a terrible shame that we couldn't do them both at the same time.
Yeah. But, you know, such are the TV scheduling gods. It's one of the best things I've seen this year.
Oh, definitely.
It's my favorite thing I've written about. Like, my review is my favorite thing I've written this year, I think, maybe. It's got a great cast. It's super VFE. I don't know. It's just, if only we had, like, the Hermione thing where we could be two places at once.
You know it's called a time turner.
Whatever.
I almost said blue power.
Pretend like you're not a nerd over here.
Yeah. No, for all those reasons, of course. And also, delving into the real lives of these women that were not even included in the show. It's so fascinating.
There's a lot.
There's a lot.
So much to unpack.
And there's a lot on VF.com that you can read.
We should say that we did not get to cover it on the podcast, but we covered it in great, great detail on VF.com, largely through articles written by our own Chris Murphy.
This is true. And they're good.
All right. So let's do a quick recap and remind you what happened on this season of Feud. The Swans are a group of New York socialites who love Truman Capote. This is at least until he writes about their secrets.
Truman, don't
I don't
that.
Understand why nobody is able to look past the surface and appreciate the writing itself, which is accurate. It is an accurate account. Does it mean that I don't love them, the people that
No, Truman, there's no love in those pages. All it is a collection of cruel scalpel cuts without the benefit of anesthesia.
Truman falls from favor with the women and struggles with addiction, writer's block, and a violent lover.
Oh? Well, baby doll, vodka stings more than your fist, baby.
Babe Haley, who was particularly targeted by Capote's pen, is dying of cancer. She goes on a journey of forgiveness.
Sometimes I just wish I'd laughed it off when it came out, and he'd be sitting here right now with us, and wouldn't that be nice?
As for Truman, he is tormented by his damaged relationships with the Swans and dies with his final book, Answered Prayers, unfinished.
What do you say?
Beautiful babe.
So I feel like we should start off by saying that I know all three of us watched all of Feud, Capote versus the Swans, and just really drank it up.
Yeah, I mean, I reviewed it for the site, and I was like, oh, it's just, you know, it's not this campy sort of bitch fest I thought it might be.
Yeah, just like quips and empty, shallow treatment.
Exactly. It's a sad, thoughtful show. And then I reread my review of Feud, Bette and Joan, and it's like, that was also sad and thoughtful. I kind of had misremembered, because you hear Ryan Murphy, you hear the word feud, you hear Betty Davis, Joan Crawford, Truman Capote. Oh, this is going to be, you know, X thing.
And it's going to be like, cat fights. Yeah. It's going to be throwing drinks in faces.
Yeah, and it's really not. And I think Feud in particular, you know, as written by John Robin Bates, several episodes directed by Gus Van Sant, like, is especially sensitive and almost quiet given its sort of larger-than-life personalities that it's about. It really contextualizes them in, like, human shape, which I really appreciate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Chris, I feel like you covered it more than anybody at VF.com. Were you surprised by it in the same way?
Yes, in a similar way as Richard. I think, you know, there's, when you hear Ryan Murphy, there's just so much content. You think American Horror Story, you think American Crime Story. The Feud is a whole different thing. They all are tonally very different than if you can easily confuse all of them and mishmash what Ryan Murphy is and whatnot. And with this iteration of Feud, he really was sort of hands-off. He didn't write it. He didn't direct any of it. I interviewed Jessica Lange. She was like, I missed him a lot. He was not really that involved in
the day-to-day.
In the day-to-day of Feud Capote. You know, Ryan Murphy has his touch, his sort of specific quirks and whatnot, but I really found this iteration to be sort of like a meditation on life and death and very like ethereal and kind of amorphous and kind of a beautiful lyrical sort of rumination on New York and also aging and having being the toast of the town and then being cast out. And I think that's so interesting. I love when, you know, a woman looking at a mirror saying, what have I done? Like, and that was very much the ethos of the show.
Olympica.
Yeah. Seeing that on Thursday.
I think that if you kind of look back at the American Blank story, like, oeuvre, this is maybe more in line with the Versace season of American Crime Story, which also, you know, after the O.J. Simpson's episodes, which were just so wild, so overly stuffed with all these amazing actors doing all of these doing performances of all of these larger than life characters. And then you got Versace, which was a lot quieter. And I mean, it's about a serial killer, but it is not over the top in like a Glee kind of way. Mm-hmm. It's very meditative, like you were saying. It's kind of got a deeply melancholy core, just a lot of rumination on queerness and how that makes people outsiders and how that feeling can kind of lead to these, in the particular case of the guy who murdered Gianni Versace, an act of violence. And honestly, Capote is kind of a similar story. It's about a kind of consummate insider-outsider who commits this act of violence against the people in his circle for various motivations. Obviously, he doesn't actually kill anybody firsthand, but somebody does die because of it in the very first episode of the series.
Yeah. It's about someone who is status hungry and gets close and then destroys it.
Yes.
And I think that it's an especial feat of the show that it gets us to care so much about these people when, by all accounts, Truman Capote, not a great guy.
Yeah.
And the women that he was friends with slash antagonizing, Babe Paley, all these other people, I mean, I can't speak to their character. I don't know what quite, I mean, I know what we see on the show, but like represent something at best ridiculous and at worst sort of morally evil in an economic sense.
Yeah.
You know, and in other senses. So the fact that the show gets us to not only care about these specific characters, but sort of see something sad and relatable, strangely, in what they represent, an end of an era, obsolescence as we age, feelings of imposter syndrome, and always being the outsider, no matter how inside something we are. That's a really, really tricky feat, and I think the show is all the better for even bothering to do that. Because again, the other version where it's just kind of saucy and ridiculous would also be very entertaining, and we'd probably still be talking about it.
Totally. Yeah.
And there are some saucy, ridiculous moments.
I mean, sure.
Demi Moore, you know, hurling a drink, calling Truman a little F slur in the first episode.
Swanning into the black and white ball in her feathered
armor. Get up, in a mask. Like, there are elements of that which, again, sort of like catnip on top of the core, which, as both of you have said, is a lot more melancholy and fair. It didn't seem to judge anyone too harshly before sort of presenting their case, whether that's Babe Paley, whether that's Sam Keith, whether it's Truman himself, who is so tragic because he did have such talent and he did want to be a part of this world. I think anybody who's ever been in high school or college or middle school, like, you know, they're the popular girls, you kind of want to be friends with them even if they're bad people. And that's sort of kind of presented in a delicate and kind of heartbreaking way, that he sort of got his entree into this society, into upper crust, ladies who lunch, old guard society, never was going to really fit in, but had real relationships. It did really seem like they cared about him, and ruined it for a quick buck, notoriety, one could say many reasons. So watching that fallout and beginning with that, like, initial, like, boom, implosion, I saw some people who were sort of like, I don't know why, like, we dove right in the first episode with the essential feud. But I think starting from that explosion and then sort of falling out of that and watching the slow spiral of alcoholism and self-destruction that caused was really harrowing and really, ugh.
Yeah, I can see that, although I will say that I think my one complaint about the show is that there's too much timeline jumping. I think that it kind of falls victim to, like, peak TV-itis, where there's some sense that telling the story linearly isn't enough and we have to do a bunch of bobbing and weaving and jumping and cutting. Yeah, and I mean, honestly, that feels kind of Ryan Murphy influenced.
Where
we don't have the confidence in being able to just start the story at the beginning and kind of see it through the end. I could understand maybe beginning with a flash forward and then kind of telling. I wish that it had done it in that order. I think it would have had a greater impact.
I think so too. And it is a crutch of modern television, unfortunately, because I think part of that is maybe a sort of nervousness on the writer's part, but also maybe sort of a network demand, which is like, you got to start with something big. And if the big thing is only going to happen 7 hours into your story, then you kind of have to tease that somehow.
Yeah.
But I also think that because this story spans so many years, that I really had a hard time being like, okay, so which era of Babe Paley is this? How sick is she right here? You know, they did a good job, both in Naomi Watts' performance, but and also hair and makeup and all that. You know, she was clearly sicker in some scenes than others, but, like, I just didn't feel the full impact of her slow wasting away because we kept then jumping back to when she was healthier. And I don't know, I feel like they lost some dramatic impact because they wanted Truman's story, which was mostly a downward line, to feel more dynamic.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, watching somebody just kind of spend 10 years committing suicide is a little, I guess, dramatically limp.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Even if it's true to life.
You have to have moments where you're like, oh, maybe he is better. But it's like, no, that's because this is in the past. And, you know, like James Baldwin coming to his rescue and sort of trying to set him back on course was never going to happen because he was already in Paris, he doesn't live here.
Yeah, that was sort of like a weak point for me, the James Baldwin episode, just because it felt a little bit like, okay, well, we got to fill some time here, and what if we did this thought experiment? It felt like a play, and I love plays, but
one of those plays where two people who may have never actually interacted much in real life are suddenly spending a day together.
Yeah, like an MFA project in that way. But even so, I think looking back on it, to give Feud some credit, it was creative and more, and I can understand why you would need some thrust of him, you know, getting his mojo back. And maybe, you know, if he did get a pep talk from James Baldwin, maybe that would give him some pep in a step to pick up the pen and start, you know, writing down. Where if you just look at the overall arc of his life, and if you kept it way more Wikipedia-y and, you know, this is what happened and this is what happened, the show would probably fizzle out and not really be able to sustain the eight episodes that it had.
Yeah, I think that the way that it manages to hang on, even though it's maybe a little long and even though there's a lot of jumping, I think that Tom Hollander deserves, like, an enormous amount of credit for how good the show is. His Capote you know, is in the shadow, obviously, of many other Capote.
Philip Seymour Hoffman?
Yeah, Philip Seymour Hoffman, most famously, won an Oscar for it in the movie Capote in 2005. But Tom Hollander is playing Capote at a different era in his life, you know, at the end, kind of once the early promise has all frittered away. And he really nails it. Like, this is a difficult man to bring to life because his actual voice sounds like somebody doing an impression of Truman Capote.
Yes, it's one of those things where if you didn't know what Truman sounded like, you would watch this show and be like,
what is he doing?
This is ridiculous. And that happens sometimes with these kind of big performances. And Hollander, he really nails it. He's pitiable. He's detestable. He's kind of all those things. And like, I think going back to the Baldwin episode, something I like about how it sort of further deepens the characterization of Capote is that it does for a moment offer you a glimpse of like what he was trying to do actually might have mattered. Mm-hmm. Like it might have broken something open. I mean, that thing was kind of crumbling anyway, but like, you know, and I think that Hollander similarly finds some dignity in him, even at the lowest, like, and I'm not saying that there's, I mean, you know, not the alcoholism that killed him. That's a disease that he was suffering from. Mm-hmm. I just mean when he's being really shitty. Even then, I'm like, but I kind of understand the bedrock humanity underneath all this, you know. And that's hard to do. And I almost, I think Hoffman's wonderful in Capote, but it doesn't feel as deep as this one does for me.
Yeah. I mean, it's so easy for Capote to fall into caricature, just given the way that he talks and the way that he is and whatnot. And Hollander is really doing something. I mean, he's really historically accurate. And to the point where I was like going back and looking up, you know, Capote drunk on television, these interviews, you can find this stuff on YouTube. And he nails it while also not doing a one-to-one impression. I feel sort of across the board, I'm not as interested in, you know, actors sort of doing like perfect impersonations of people who live. That's not really as exciting to me.
You don't want to see that Robin Williams guy's Robin Williams movie?
I absolutely do not want to see that at all. And I do think, you know, led by Hollander, the ensemble really, I think, came through with these really fully realized performances of these real people.
And to act against this big performance in Hollander and to have everything feel of the same world, I think is a real accomplishment. I think it's especially exciting for Naomi Watts, you know, because she's a great actor. She's had a lot of success, don't get me wrong. But something in her career, I have this sort of theory about her, is that she makes a lot of the right choices, but it's the wrong time. Like, she does a Noah Baumbach movie, but it's not the right Noah Baumbach movie. She does the Peter Jackson movie, but it's not quite the right Peter Jackson movie. You know, she just kind of has
A Diana kind of before the big wave of Diana stuff, but it's maybe just not the right script.
Exactly. So so this feels like right time, right role. Everything is in you know, kind of agreement with each other. This is her second Gus Van Sant project after a movie called The Sea of Trees that I don't know if any of you, either of you have ever seen.
I have not.
My first experience with a movie being horribly booed at Cannes.
Oh, God.
Anyway, this is a nice redemption for the two of them to working together. I just think she's so good and, like Hollander does, gives Paley so much depth and dimension in a way that, like, was her life actually like that? I mean, I don't know, but like from the outside, it's like that's a pretty shallow existence. It's appearance, it's wealth, it's parties, it's dinners, whatever. But finding what's behind that is both an accomplishment of writing and I think Watts. And I hope that she will be not overlooked come Emmy's time.
I think that's some of the best work Watts has ever done, in my opinion.
Yeah.
In Feud. And interesting that you mention was she really like that, because Watts' performance and the characterization of Babe got her granddaughter talking. Belle Burden wrote an op-ed in the New York Times that was basically saying that was not my grandmother. She was much nicer. She was an attentive grandmother. She was much deeper and less obsessed with materialistic things than the show portrayed her to be. I mean, I can understand, obviously, watching, you know, a fictionalized version of your grandmother is going to trigger some things. But I do think that, you know, Naomi Watts was so much more than just a socialite or someone who only cared about appearances. We got into the really sort of well-documented terrible marriage between Babe Paley and her husband, Bill Paley. And that aside, the foundation, the crux of the show was the relationship between Babe and Truman. And that really did shine through, especially at the end. There are lyrical scenes where they're both dying when we have the Babe in the pink dress and the swan in the bathtub, and they sort of reconcile even though that never really happened. That's, I think, where the show, the thrust of the show was going and what I took away from it more so than the actual literal details of was Babe Paley a good mother or not.
Yeah, it does have a heart. And I mean, Truman's last words really were beautiful Babe,
yeah,
which
that's
is
crazy.
A crazy thing. I mean,
yeah. Read that in a Vanity Fair article. We reported that.
Yeah, vanityfair.com by Chris Murphy. Or Julie Miller. I don't remember which of you wrote that.
I
but all right. All credit due to Chris. But yeah, I mean, just casting in general on this show, I think, is really spot on, not only because everybody is performing well, but because, as with previous anthology Ryan Murphy projects, there is really an eye toward casting people who have long careers, whose kind of very presence represents something greater than just the character. Uh-huh. Like, it's he has a habit, like a very, I think, great instinct toward, like, casting women who are over the age of, you know, 45, mm-hmm. Who had great moments of fame early in their careers and are less cast now, mostly because mm-hmm. Hollywood is very sexist and doesn't believe that older women deserve, you know, to have their faces shown on screen. And so, you know, you look at the cast and you've got people like Calista Flockhart, who just, like, doesn't act very much anymore. Mm-hmm. You've got Molly Ringwald, who kind of became, you know, an author and a translator and is very far removed from her Brat Pack days. You've got Demi Moore, who also, you know, represented this giant A-lister in the 90s and is now, you know, less seen on screen. It's like, it's a great way to become reacquainted with these people who we feel we knew so well at one point. And yeah, it's just a kind of delightful to see them all brought together in this way. And, you know, they are all also very good on the show.
Yeah. And I think Demi Moore, you know, playing this tragic figure on the show, like, in a much less dramatic fashion, like, Demi Moore, you know, career-wise had a pretty big fall from grace. I mean, the highest paid actress in the world. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, 2 years later, she was a nobody. You know, like, mm-hmm. I'm sure that she brought that to the table. Molly Ringwald feeling her character feeling like an outsider. Even, you know, she's Johnny Carson's ex-wife. Mm-hmm. She's living a perfectly comfortable life out in L.A., but by the East Coast standards,
she's not a swan.
She is by no means a swan. I think it's very shrewd casting. Diane Lane is really fun.
Mm-hmm. You've got, like, Diane Lane and Chloe Sevigny, both of whom are, like, still pretty regularly getting work. But, you know, it's nice to see them in this mode, too.
But I think also as a comment on, like, the aging of it all, like, we knew Chloe Sevigny when she was a teenager. Mm-hmm. We met Diane Lane. I mean, I was not alive, but she was a young, you know, started out young.
Totally.
As did Ringwald, as did Moore, really, essentially. And to see them, like, now as, like, full-grown people and getting to explore the contours of that is cool. And I think that it works in an extra meta context for this show, which is about a gay man's regard for women he admires and envies and is both responsible for their fabulousness but also beholden to it, and mm-hmm. the relationships are loving and also transactional.
It's a really complicated relationship. It's a question of who's using who and when and for what. And the kind of answer is always shifting, which is super interesting too. It's not as simple as, you know, he sold out his friends or they wanted a gay mascot to make them laugh at their parties. Like, it's mm-hmm. it's kind of both things at the same time and neither.
True.
And the show does poke at, especially in the James Baldwin episode, the notion of, like, well, gay men are trotted out as sort of props by these straight women. And I understand where that argument's coming from. I don't know that this show is necessarily a successful, nor is it maybe intending to be, like, dissection of the straight woman, gay man friendship. Yeah. I mean, there are elements to that, but I don't think that's, like, one of the core theses. Or am I wrong?
I agree. I do think it's more, you have that dynamic, I think, that's really Truman and Babe, right? That's the core friendship. That's the main gay man, straight woman relationship. And then I do think it's more about how group dynamics and in-group dynamics, and I do think what we haven't really talked about that much is these class dynamics. Truman being an outsider, being queer, marginalized in that way, but also, you know, being from the South, being, you know, having being a striver, having actual talent in a way that these women...
And being self-made.
And being self-made in a way that these women, for all their beauty and their grace and their privilege and their access, will never have and will never be, how easy it was for them to cast him aside the minute that he didn't fall in line. And although, at this, by the same token, what he wrote was really mean. What he did was really mean.
If you go back and read the actual story, which you can,
it's not very nice, and it's very clear who he's talking about, and he does sort
of... Well, sometimes he uses their real names.
So I think that's why it was so compelling to me, is because you can see both sides in regards to, you know, Truman is writing about this society. He knows that it will be catnip to the world, and and that people want to know how the lives of these rich and famous, these it girls, live. And he ultimately sacrifices his relationships with them in a really sort of potentially objectionable way for the sake of his art. And Babe, her constant push and pull of wanting to let him back in because she did really love him. That is compelling television to me.
Yeah, and also the question of, you know, he sold them out for what? He never finished the book.
He never finished the book.
Would he have finished the book if he hadn't published that early on and gotten them to throw him out? Like, was he capable of finishing it?
At that stage, and as his alcoholism worsened, like, you know, it became so clear that it was a pipe dream, that was probably never going to happen. But would it have all have gotten so bad had he not published that?
That's an interesting thought experiment.
Yeah.
I thought about Tiger King, where it's like, okay, so you live with the tigers and it's fine, but maybe that tiger's going to attack you at some point. It's a bit like, oh, so you made friends with a writer, and you told him a lot of things.
A lot of secrets.
Are you sure you're fully comfortable with that? You know?
So it's a frog-scorpion parable.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, you know, and I think that's an interesting tension that the show does kind of explore, which is like, these women knew exactly what kind of writer Truman Capote was. I mean, they can't imagine that the people surrounding the Clutter family who were, the murder victims in Cold Blood, like, people in that Kansas town were close-ish to him as he reported that, but also probably angry at him after the fact or during everything. And it's like...
Well, the murderer certainly was.
Well,
you know?
Right,
he
exactly.
opened up.
Like, yeah. Exactly. And that's what brought him all this esteem and brought him into the fold of the Swans of the Upper East Side. And it's like, but you don't think that he might do that with you?
And they're naive.
I mean, in the show's portraiture...
Not me, I'm different.
They seem really taken aback by it, where it's just hindsight, I suppose. Where it's like, you probably should have seen. You are too interesting in your fabulous, moneyed way for this person not to write about it in some capacity.
Yeah, it was very naive.
The thing about it is that there's 8 hours, and I do still kind of feel like I wanted more time with each of them.
Yeah.
And there are entire swans that weren't even covered
completely
in the show.
Rory Guinness. There are a couple.
Maria Agnelli.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, who are fascinating in their own right.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I would love... I mean, maybe I'm taking all the wrong things away from this show, but I would love, like, a spinoff, you know, where it's, like, more time with the swans, you know.
Yes.
Yeah.
After dinner drinks with the swans, you know.
Because watch what happens with the swans.
Yeah, exactly.
That's like, what we have
it,
now.
I mean, that's the thing, and I wrote about this in my review, where it's, like, it presents this world that is, by many accounts, gross. And yet... I'm
glamorous.
Fascinated by it. I'm attracted to it. And I think that the show does a good job of creating for the audience something maybe like what Truman felt about it, which was that mix of horror
disgust.
And awe and, you know. And I
think, need to be a part of it.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think that for the show's shape to be such that someone like Radziwill, who is so fascinating, only flits in around the edges, you know, and then drifts off into a really interesting life.
Yeah.
You know, it's tantalizing. And maybe that's the whole point. We only see her for that little bit to suggest that there was a world just outside of this that was also interesting and, you know.
Yeah, totally. It's like, you know, watching Oppenheimer and he's having a conversation with Einstein and there's some weird guy over there. And it's like, oh, he's Gödel. He's a very famous mathematician.
Famous, right.
Very important. And like, he's just a tiny footnote in this bigger story.
Right, right. Yeah. Exactly. And, you know, there's a lot of 70s New York nostalgia, you know, the sort of pre-AIDS disco party era, interesting fashion, Warhol, all that stuff happening. And to see this show, which is about, it goes into that a little bit, obviously, but like really end of an era, I find it's a really interesting narrow sliver of New York nostalgia.
It's hard to think of another television show that's attempted to render that specific feeling of ennui and loss in such a way.
I watched it and I was like, oh, okay, this is something that was made just for us.
Yeah. it really was. Actresses acting. And
I wrote a little something that's going to be in the next issue of VF about all the dad shows that are out right now. Mm. And this feels like the antithesis of
show.
That. Yes, this is a mom show.
And an uncle show.
Listen, moms aren't just women.
It's true. No, it is. And I think that it's helped me sort of shake off some crusty ideas I had about what a Ryan Murphy produced show is going to be. Mm-hmm. And also forced me to remember that a lot of the stuff in the past that he's produced has also been thoughtful and interesting.
Yeah.
American Crime Story, The Other Feud, you know, like, as long as he's kind of churning out things like this.
And I think as long as he's also mediated to some degree.
Yeah.
Well, no, exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, exactly. Like, it's
voices
it's
in the room.
Like the OJ show, this, like Versace, like those were written by other people, you know, directed in some cases by Murphy. But like, if we get a feud every couple, like, or something of this quality every couple of years, he can do as many American Horror Stories as he wants. Like,
yeah, no, totally. There's an American sports story coming out about Aaron Hernandez, which is a very different sort of story, a much more mask story than this.
Although
MASC.
Well, yeah, there's some stuff. There.
Yes, that's true. But like, I'm very, you know, I'm very eager to see what his team does with that, because it is another very wide range. Like, there are a lot of issues in there. There's football culture. There's masculinity. Media. There's race. There's media. There's
Massachusetts.
The most toxic of them.
Do you think the show will include the scene where my sister's then boyfriend made us drive by his house?
Yeah. That's going to be the opening shot, right?
That's a bottle episode. Yeah.
Oh, good. Okay.
You guys in the car going to the house.
I mean, being like, who? What?
He did what? Yeah.
So stay tuned for that season of Still Watching.
Still Watching will be back in just a moment when we return a conversation with Feud, Capote vs. the Swans showrunner John Robin Bates.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
A few weeks ago, I didn't have to worry about lunch for 6 glorious days thanks to a box stuffed with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Everything I tasted was fresh, healthy, and ready to eat in 2 minutes or less, from jalapeno lime cheddar chicken with spicy cilantro cauliflower rice to wellness juice shots made with apple, ginger, lemon, and cayenne. Next time, maybe I'll add on some breakfast, too. I've got my eye on their cherry almond pancakes. Factor offers 35 menu options every week, including meals tailored to specific dietary needs like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, Vegan and Veggie, and for Earth Month, food with a particularly low carbon footprint. The add-ons go beyond pancakes. You can also load up your box with everything from keto-friendly cheesecake to an extra filet mignon just because. The service is tailored to your schedule, built so you can get as many or as few meals as you need. Head to factormeals.com/stillwatching50 and use code stillwatching50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code STILLWATCHING50 at factormeals.com/stillwatching50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You can earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply. There is a lot to cover when it comes to what's true and what is fiction in Feud, Capote versus the Swans.
And who better to ask about that than John Robin Bates, who's the writer and showrunner of the series, and he's joining us right now.
So hello and welcome to the podcast, John Robin Bates.
Thank you very much. You can call me Robbie as much as you like.
So I'm so curious, Robbie, how did you first get involved in this edition of Feud? Were you a fan of the first season of Feud? How did you get involved?
I'm friends with Ryan and Ryan Murphy, and we've kept on bugging each other about things to do together. And I sort of love all of the things he manages to make. There's so many, but I've always had this idea that he's sort of telling this alternate history of the United States in things like American Horror and the first Feud. It's always a kind of sort of unreported psychodrama that goes to the core of like the American berserk, you know? And so I liked the first one. We tried to do another one, but we couldn't quite get lift off with it. Ooh. Just textually.
About what?
Was that the Charles and Diana one?
Yes. Oh. But so it was sort of this idea. It was like a kind of series of Francis Bacon paintings of Charles and Diana. It just seemed sort of futile in a way to be going up against the Crown, which owned that part of the street. So we sort of abandoned it, even though kind of we liked the few scripts we did. It just felt like, wait, we're going to be running at the same time. That will become the story. The show won't be the story itself. Everything will be compared to everything else. Mm. The worst thing that can happen in life is that your life turns into a horse race. So we both sort of abandoned it. And then when Lawrence Lehmer's book, Capote and the Swans, came out, we both independently read it, and I sent him a note. And I said, hey, I think this is a feud, and it's got everything in it, but particularly all the things that we're kind of interested in, which is being out of time and being out of sync with time. And he wrote back to me minutes later, already optioned the book, let's do it.
You gotta love that.
Yeah, great minds, and, yeah.
I didn't realize that meant that it was actually already on the FX Hulu schedule.
Oh.
So I approached it with my usual gentleman farmer kind of elan, which is to slowly water the ground and slowly plant some more seeds. And he, you know, said to me, what are you doing? We're making this really soon. So we worked together, and indeed you saw the result.
How simpatico were you and Ryan about the tone of the show? Because I think there's definitely a version of this same story that's just, you know, heightened bitchiness and catfights at restaurants and swanning sort of through the black and white ball, but not, you know, but that episode has a great sadness underneath mm-hmm. it. And I'm just curious about how you developed the tone of the show, because I found it so arresting and kind of surprising in a way.
Yeah, it's not camp.
Well,
yeah.
I mean... notwithstanding the brilliance of Susan Sontag, I don't really have much taste for camp, personally. I know that's anathema to say that, but I'm interested in melancholy and sorrow and loss and the clock running out and the pain of losing the things that make you you. And Ryan, I think, saw it very similarly. We had these extraordinarily intimate conversations, usually late at night when we were working together on formulating it, usually accompanied by a martini. You know, this would be over the phone. And we would talk about what love means and what friendship means. And I think both of us were going through that moment in your life in your late 50s, early 60s maybe, where you're on the other side of the seesaw suddenly, and the clock is ticking, but there are fewer hours. You're just vaguely conscious of the passage of time is now different. Not only, you know, we all notice that life speeds up as we get older, but this was also about what you value in your life as the clock ticks away. And I found Truman to be heartbreakingly reckless. And so I talked about that a lot. Ryan, in addition to those qualities, had a kind of uncanny idea of abandoning traditional sort of structures like, you know, that come right out of, you know, young Mr. Lincoln in Illinois and, you know, Marie Curie. And it just had to be different. And so it became kind of odd tableau of memory fading in and out.
Yeah, I mean, I think something, little scene that I found so striking on the show is, you know, Truman's fallen out with his old friends. He's looking for someone new. He meets this young woman, and he was kind of styling her like Babe Bailey, you know. And I think it's Richard Avedon, the actor, who says,
what's the matter with you? What do you think you're doing? It's 1978. What year are you stuck in?
Well, I can't tell you, honestly.
Jesus, True. What are you doing? Are you working?
Yes, on the book, Dickie.
No, you're not.
it really struck me then, and then the rest of as the rest of the show proceeded, that like this is also a show about like the end of an era, not just for these individual people, but for an entire time in like American life.
Yeah, when Chloe Sevigny, Cece Guest, is shopping for a hat and realizes, you know, does anyone still wear a hat?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I think that's my favorite episode. It's hats, gloves, and it feet homosexuals. And,
yeah,
it's a very sad episode. For all of the reasons you mention, and it has all of the things that I love. You realize that the glove counter at Saks is gone. And I think in the credits it says smirking saleswoman. she sort of, you know, smirks. And they've gone from this sense of being at the center of a world, which is easily something that can happen to you in New York. To this day, you sort of have this illusion that it's the most important place in the world. But suddenly everything is gone, and the fashions that were so important, that you fetishized, that you set, are laughable. And I guess the other part of the show that is so great in that episode to me is the way time leaves you behind, that nothing is finite. And what was beautiful today is going to be terrifying tomorrow, or a joke, indeed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems like a tough line to walk with the writing, and certainly also with the acting, to kind of hit the right balance between all of these different notes. Can you talk a little bit about the casting process? Who was the first person cast? Kind of was Tom Hollander, you know, the first on your list?
Tom was sort of right up there in sync with Naomi Watts doing Babe. And it all came together very quickly. You know, Tom did a sort of version of Truman, which only showed how much range he had and how much depth he could get right away, and that it was a profoundly psychological little glimpse into the man. And it wasn't a sketch, so you saw that right away. I think that there's this kind of remarkable thing. I always say, you know, you have to cast for intelligence. Mm. It's how you get metaphor built in. It's a certain kind of intelligence. It's not necessarily, you know, someone who can do quantum physics, but it's about living in metaphor and living in... Let me tell you a quick story that helps clarify this. I was helping Mike Nichols, the late, great Mike Nichols. He was directing a new version, a new production of the Clifford Odets play, The Country Girl. And I had done a couple of minor kind of revisions to it with the permission of the estate. But I watched Mike rehearse, and his entire method of rehearsing was to tell anecdotes and to somehow convey what was wanted, what was needed, the temperature of a scene through anecdote. And you either got that or you didn't. It was about thinking abstractly, connectively. All of these actors had that quality, you know, Diane Lane, Calista Flockhart, Chloe, the Swans, and certainly Joe Mantello. You know, he almost, and this is a compliment, acts like a director. So you cast really well, and it's 90% of everything, I think. Mm. They're very, very smart in different ways. And together you get this kind of soup of clashing feelings. That's why those scenes at Le Côte Basque feel athletic to you if you watch. There's something exhilarating about the combination of Gus's brilliant work with the camera and composition and the shifting agendas at that table at the restaurant. I the process. And then you had young Ella Beatty, who played the kind of quiet, grateful mortification, you know, the combination of ambivalence and gratitude so well. She was the young lady that Truman took under his wing, the daughter of his brutal lover, John O'Shea. What?
It's just so wild that that is not something you made up for the show, that that actually happened.
Well, I made up a lot of things, but that was one of the things that, yes, was kind of really remarkable. It was a way for him to assuage something, I thought, actually, or to try to.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, anyway.
Oh, on the subject of what you made up and what really happened, I found these women who I really didn't know, Babe Paley or Slim Keith or Cece Guest, any of these women before watching the series, and I found them to be fascinating, and I did all this research about their actual lives, and any one of them could have held down a series of Feud or a season of Feud by themselves. But the combination of what you took from each of their lives was so fascinating and so interesting. I mean, Truman Capote versus Gore Vidal could have been a whole season of Feud, too. How did you decide what to take and what to discard from their lives when putting together this season? Because there's just such a wealth of material there.
I think Ryan and I looked at the places where the conflict was the animating factor in their relationship, and juxtaposed those moments with the places of joy and conviviality of being in concert with one another. There was so much. When I talked before about different temperatures, I think what I'm really talking about is the way in which different agendas have different currents that go in different directions. And so you could juxtapose what, for instance, Slim Keith wanted against the thing that Babe wanted. Babe, in many ways, was the perfect sort of antagonist within the Swans. She kind of, her heart was broken, but she yearned for peace. You see that again and again. Slim wants vengeance. She's driven to war. Her heart rate quickens at the thought of blood. Lee, who, you know, I was sort of weirdly obsessed with, partially because I love Callista so much and knew right away that she was going to do it, and we'd done this other show together. But Lee's animating force was bitterness and jealousy. Mm. Chloe's lovely, brittle savoir-faire. So all of those things kind of come into great conflict with one another. And, you know, once you're, I think, is it a playwright thing? I mean, drama doesn't begin until some sort of ritual is broken. There is no drama in the everyday banality of your rituals. It's when something breaks it that there's drama. And I also thought a lot about, to answer your question differently, the Aristotelian notion that character is fate. I always go by that. Your character is your fate. You're going to earn you're going to get the face you earned in life. Mm. You never don't see it happen, you know. I mean, Donald Trump certainly has the face he's earned.
Very true.
That is real.
Still Watching will be back with more John Robin Bates, the showrunner of FX's Feud, Capote vs. the Swans.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love. Books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson.
Oh.
Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. The jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't
miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
And we're back with John Robin Bates, or Robbie. So how did your opinion of Capote change in the process of making this show? It's easy to have a lot of preconceived notions about who he was and what he represents, but obviously people are very complex. And so I'm just curious how you sort of, your opinion of him and your idea of his legacy evolved.
It's a great question because it did evolve. The more I knew, the more I wanted to not get to meet one of the people you most admire, the more awful I felt it would be. You know, I've been to some pretty awful dinner parties in my life with some very famous people. And sometimes that can go very, very badly. And they end up being repellent to you because they're cruel or dismissive or posing and posturing, whatever. Sometimes you get completely surprised the other way. With Truman, it's sort of a case of, is the wit worth it? Because the cruelty certainly isn't. So I didn't love spending all that time with him. And this was a first for me because I don't write from rage towards someone or dislike. I mostly felt a sense of kind of aching disappointment about who he was, how he squandered what he had been given, how inevitable it was, but at the same time, how brave he had been at times in his life, how much pain there was, how it was sort of a wonder that he got to the point that he did. But life is tiring, and I think he ran out of the kinds of stamina that you need. I think it's a Yeats line, exile, silence, and cunning, qualities that you sort of need to survive in the world, especially if you're kind of maybe an artist. He didn't have the troika of those three. And so he depleted himself, I felt, on that which is the quick hit of public adulation. His internal life was marred. I mean, maybe I'm being too articulate about things that you already know, but I found it heartbreaking again and again to have to write these scenes where, like, we see him drunk on Stanley Siegel's television show, for instance.
Here's a question I'd like to ask you. It's a serious question, and that is this. What is going to happen unless you lick this problem of drugs and alcohol? What is going to happen to Truman? I'm sure you...
The obvious answer is that eventually, I'll kill myself.
Yes.
Without meaning to.
You see how awful he is, all of which is substantiated by collected stories. Talent gets a free pass sometimes, and you get to be outré because you're entertaining. But I was left feeling very sad and hollow by him. At the same time, yet another layer of this, because everything is everything, nothing is one thing, I sort of found the genius in Le Cote Basque as well, that it was a bit of virtuoso writing, that there were dazzling bits here and there, but that only made it all worse. I kept yearning for him to listen to Jack, played by Joe Mantello, and go to Switzerland and have some consommé and some discipline. But he's a very sad character to write. And yet, I think maybe there are people in the world whose genius burns very, very, very bright and costs them the only thing they have, which is at that moment, not just their genius, but their youthful energy. And I suspect that the cost of writing In Cold Blood was so high and he was so torn apart by his own relationship to those killers that for the rest of time, he operated out of a desire to be numb. Why else would he? There's a wonderful photograph of him somewhere. Dick Cavett talks about this in, I think, the George Plimpton documentary, of Truman up on stage at a Rolling Stones concert with the Stones, and he's sort of dancing in the corner, and Cavett says, sort of in wonderment, what was he doing up there? What was that about? Why was he there? He was trying to write a story about the Stones, who despised him. He behaved sort of like Truman. But, you know, what was Truman Capote doing most of the time? Yeah. He was not a guardian of his own worth. That was a really long answer to that question.
Yeah, that was really
There's a lot to say.
There is a lot.
So, yeah, so did writing the finale episode, you know, where he kind of has this wish fulfillment moment where he gets to, you know, give the swans what they always wanted, did that feel cathartic to you?
It felt kind to me in a way that he was capable of, even in his hallucinatory sort of DTs as he's dying kind of state of being, fantasizing about giving them gifts, being generous. Because I think he was a very generous man in his own weird way. But there's no catharsis in any of it. The catharsis is in the final moment when the director, the first DP, says, cut. That's a wrap. You know, that's like you've sticked the landing, as they say. You got out alive, and you know it. But the story itself doesn't do that. It just makes you pretty sad, you know. And this story was quite sad making, albeit funny at times. There's something maybe you don't notice very much in the last episode. Early on, we meet Phyllis Diller at Joanna Carson's house. She's not referred to as, but you know it's Phyllis Diller. Mm. The very last thing that happens in the show is that little auction.
Yeah.
Well, that was a real auction where the ashes are being auctioned off. But the next item being auctioned off, and you hear it in the distance, you don't hear it very clearly, the auctioneer says, and next up is Phyllis Diller's caftan. And those are the last words you sort of hear before those ladies disappear into the... But that's what it's come to. Phyllis Diller's caftan and Truman Capote's ashes. So you might as well not be an asshole to people.
Good lesson.
I think a good lesson for us all.
Good lesson. I quickly, just while we're on the subject of the last episode, I know I interviewed Jessica Lange, and she said that she, you know, she had a wonderful time working on the show, and that she actually wanted to play both Truman's mother and his beloved aunt in that final episode. So I'm curious as to whether you ever wrote scenes for that, or how, you know, what happened to that idea. And
it's a good idea. It's a great idea, but you have to sort of, at a certain point, you're racing towards the finish, and it's so, could be so, I see the scene, and I see where to put it, but, you know, we were already straining people's patience with my decoration of reality. I mean, I think it would have been just sort of what the British like to call over-egging the pudding. An expression that's as bewildering to me now as it was the first time I heard it. But there was almost no room. Listen, I couldn't even find room for Gloria Guinness and Marella Agnelli.
This is true.
Yeah, two swans. Two major swans.
Who were fascinating because the Marella in particular warned the other swans, he will betray you. He's Iago. So I couldn't find room for Truman's sainted auntie.
Well, you found room for a lot, and for that we are grateful, because it's just such a rich text and so beautifully performed and written. So we're really grateful for the show, and we're grateful for your time, Robbie. It's really been great to hear your insights on this great piece of work.
It was wonderful to read you guys, because there was no entropic ennui in your writing about it.
I'm gonna put that in my bio. No entropic ennui.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, that does it for this episode of Still Watching. We'll be back next week talking about HBO's The Sympathizer. This episode will drop after episode 3 of the show airs on Sunday at 9 p.m. Eastern. And for a very exciting upcoming episode, we need your help. Bravo, the great network of all networks, has just dropped some vintage gems from the early days of the network onto Peacock. Chris, can you tell us what's on that list?
Oh, I mean, it's just, it's incredible. We've got The Rachel Zoe Project, it's bananas, The Real Housewives of D.C., Shaws of Sunset, Tabitha's Salon Takeover, when she takes over the salon, she's so good, and my personal favorite, NYC Prep.
Yes, the dream of the aughts is alive on
alive
Peacock.
And well.
So if you have a story or a connection to any of those shows, an iconic moment that you'd still need to be talking about in 2024, or if you want to make the case for one of them to get a reboot or something, send us an email or a voice memo to stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. We are looking forward to talking about these shows and also to talking about what you want us to talk about. Yeah, so in the meantime, you can find me on social media at Hillabuster with two R's.
I'm at Rylaws, R-I-L-A-W-S.
And you can find me at Christris.
This has been Still Watching from Vanity Fair. Our producer is Emily Elias, and we had production help from Peyton Hayes. We were engineered and mixed by Jake Loomis. Stephen Valentino is our executive producer. Our theme music is by Alexis Quadrado. We'll be back next Sunday. Looking forward to seeing you then.
We've all been there before. You're planning a dinner party, or having family over, or even just cooking for yourself, when all of a sudden it starts to feel overwhelming.
I live in a very small one-bedroom apartment with a very small kitchen.
I can't figure out what to serve besides water soup at this point.
I'm Chris Morocco, food director of Bon Appetit and Epicurious, and this is Dinner SOS, a new podcast from Bon Appetit. Maybe it's a last-minute party with no menu inspiration, a kitchen with no space, a toddler who will only eat buttered pasta. Name your dinner emergency. We're here to help. Here's how the show works. On each episode, we'll take a call from a home cook facing a real dinner emergency. Then I'll work with one of our editors or someone from our amazing test kitchen to try and solve it. Because cooking for the people you love should inspire joy without a side of stress. Make sure you're following Dinner SOS wherever you're listening now.